in-state tuition for undocumented college students. Today, Wednesday, November 6th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A reelected governor, Chris Christie, says he's considering in-state tuition for undocumented immigrants in New Jersey. That's already happening in 15 other states, including Colorado, where this young woman goes to college.
And it helps so much, so much.
Also today, rare signs of hope in eastern Congo.
As soon as those last rounds came out of that 50 caliber gun, it was extraordinary. The civilian population just poured out.
Plus, movie theaters in Sweden adopt the Bechdel test to judge how well women are portrayed in films.
Isn't it strange that so few movies pass these three simple questions? Maybe we should do something about that.
Those stories and more ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Chances are many of you woke up this morning to political changes after yesterday's elections. New Yorkers certainly did. Progressive Democrat Bill de Blasio will replace Republican billionaire Michael Bloomberg as mayor of New York City. It's a big change that's bound to make global headlines. I spoke with John Cassidy about that. He's a staff writer with The New Yorker magazine. This isn't just about New York and New Yorkers, is it? I mean, New York is a global city, a world city. What do you think Bill de Blasio's victory actually means to the rest of the world?
Well, I think for anybody who lives in a large metropolis like New York, it means quite a lot. I mean, de Blasio is basically challenging the conventional wisdom about big cities that has been in effect for 20, 30 years. And that was that you, because of globalization and because banks and big companies like that can move around, basically they hold the whip hand and the city governments have to be pretty tame. They can't put up taxes. They have to give big companies sweetheart deals, etc., to make them locate there. De Blasio is saying, no, hang on a minute. We can actually impose a progressive agenda on a big city. We can raise taxes on some of the rich. He's going to raise taxes on anybody earning over $500,000 a year. And we can stop doing these sort of tax break deals with big corporations and use that money for things like education and other social programs. So it's a big challenge to the conventional wisdom of how you run big cities these days. And I think it does have global implications.
Is there something you know about Bill de Blasio that might lead us to believe that his ideas for big cities, like what he might do in New York, would they actually be translatable for, say, Mumbai in India?
Well, I think they're translatable anywhere. Obviously, the local context defines what you can do to some extent. But the basic idea of skimming a bit of money off the top and using it to invest in local education, for example, I think that's translatable all around the world. De Blasio's predecessor was always saying we can't raise taxes because we're in competition with London, we're in competition with Tokyo, other great, you know, international cities. And if we raise taxes too much, these companies will locate there rather than here. De Blasio's challenging that idea head on, saying, look, these people want to live in New York because it is a great city.
I mean, for the new mayor of a truly global city, Bill de Blasio has had some interesting international connections and experience. What really informed his worldview that presumably will further shape this world city?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question whether he has a really global view. I mean, he is very much a product of New York and Boston, where he grew up. But he has what we know of him is that in his younger days, he was very progressive. He was a progressive activist. He was involved in trying to get affordable housing for poor people. He was a supporter of the Nicaraguan Sandinistas and actually went down there at one point, tried to raise money for them. So he definitely comes from the world of progressive activism. However, he has changed quite a lot over the years, I would probably say evolved and matured. And he's been working within the city government or the state or the federal government for 20 years now. So we'll just have to see how he shapes up as mayor.
I mean, his wife, Shirlane McRae, also has this international connection to the Caribbean and roots that extend all the way back to Ghana. So another part of the world.
On a personal basis, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I was at de Blasio's victory party last night in Park Slope in Brooklyn, and he saw his family close up, and, you know, they do look like a Benetton ad. you know, his son has got this fantastic afro. His wife is a very striking African-American woman. he sort of gives the image to New York and to the world as this sort of multiracial family, very cosmopolitan family. And that's been a big strength to him during the campaign. In fact, Mayor Bloomberg accused him of sort of exploiting his family for political reasons. I think that was going a bit too far, but he certainly hasn't been shy about putting them out there.
John Cassidy with The New Yorker magazine, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
New Jersey Governor Chris Christie also cruised to an easy victory last night, a re-election for him. Christie is talked about as a GOP presidential contender for 2016. Activists for immigration reform are taking note. That's because Christie recently said he'd consider allowing in-state tuition for undocumented immigrants at New Jersey's public colleges. Right now, only 16 states offer lower in-state rates for undocumented students. The World's Jason Margolis reports on the latest one to sign on, Colorado.
As a child in Mexico, Josie Cordova barely knew her father. When Cordova was in the fourth grade, her mom said they were going on a vacation to see her dad, who worked in the farm fields in Colorado.
Next thing we know, like 2 weeks later, we get registered to go to school here. So I was really shocked because I'm like, are we going back to my casa? Like, I miss my bed. And then my dad was all like, no, you're going to stay here for a while.
In Denver, things began well for Cordova in elementary and middle school.
And then in high school, it was just really heartbreaking because, like, you were undocumented the last year and, like, you couldn't really apply for schools. I think some teachers were like, well, just don't go to school. Just go and work after high school. You know, like, that's pretty much your option. But it's also really risky because people have to, like, probably get paid under the table or get a fake social.
Cordova put aspirations of being a cancer researcher on hold, got a phony ID, and went to work bussing tables in a Mexican restaurant. If Cordova had graduated from high school last June instead of 3 years ago, things might have worked out differently. Last spring, after a 10-year battle, Colorado lawmakers passed a bill allowing undocumented students to pay in-state tuition rates. It's made a world of difference to 19-year-old Leslie, who asked me not to use her last name. She was brought to the U.S. illegally when she was six. Leslie was a straight-A student in a Denver high school when she graduated in 2012. Then she got three part-time jobs and went to college.
I could only afford one class. And it was ridiculously expensive. One class is almost $2,000.
This fall, the cost of college for Leslie dropped by 70%.
And it helped so much, so much.
Savings are even more dramatic at more expensive schools like Colorado State. Mike Martin is the chancellor of the Colorado State University system.
I happen to be one of those people who believes that a better educated populace anywhere, in this country and any other place, is better for the long-term survivability and prosperity of society, that education in and of itself is a good thing, despite whatever your passport or your license or your lack of either says.
Most Republican Colorado lawmakers didn't agree. They voted against the in-state tuition bill, arguing it's an amnesty for rule breakers. Many conservatives nationwide have said the same. Here's Mitt Romney at a Republican presidential debate in 2012. He's arguing against the Texas law, the first to offer in-state tuition for undocumented students.
I don't see how it is that a state like Texas, to go to the University of Texas, if you're an illegal alien, you get an in-state tuition discount. You know how much that is? It's $22,000 a year.
This fall in Colorado, about 640 undocumented students are attending public colleges and universities. Some argue this costs the state money as these students pay lower rates. Others argue the state is making money with the higher enrollment. Christine Marcus Hudson, director of the Mi Casa Resource Center in Denver, is thrilled with the new law, but she adds a dose of reality. Marcus Hudson says undocumented students still aren't eligible for Pell Grants or many scholarships.
Costs $26,000 a year to attend CU Boulder. That includes tuition, books, and dorms. But if you're a low-income kid whose parents are making minimum wage, or maybe your parents got shipped back to Mexico, how are you going to afford $26,000 a year?
Some undocumented students are finding a way. College freshman Susanna is attending the much less expensive Metropolitan State University of Denver. She got funding from the Denver Scholarship Foundation for $2,000 a semester. She's grateful for that. She wants to be a physician, but wonders what'll happen to her in 4 years.
I honestly don't know. I mean, once it's like you reach the end of the line and you have all these things, but you can't use them. I think that's the biggest problem, that even after we go to school and we acquire all these skills and things that could potentially help not only us but other people too, what do we do with that?
That question can only be addressed by lawmakers in Washington. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis, Denver.
Imagine traveling from one country to another, knowing you could be arrested the minute you arrive. Many undocumented immigrants know that feeling. So does William Potts. He was detained by the FBI today, right after he landed in Miami on a charter plane from Cuba. He knew that might happen. 29 years ago, Potts hijacked a Piedmont Airlines flight from Newark to Miami. Potts claimed he was a member of the Black Liberation Army and forced the pilots to land in Cuba. He expected a hero's welcome from communist authorities there. Instead, they arrested him, and he wound up spending 13 years in a Cuban jail. He's lived on the island ever since, but now he's returned to face a still-pending U.S. indictment against him. AP reporter Peter Orsi is in Havana. He talked to William Potts yesterday before he left.
Well, he says he feels like he needs closure. He wants to put this behind him. He said on this occasion and also in the past that he has, you know, regret for what he's done. He refers to himself, or has referred to himself in the past, as the homesick hijacker. And so I think what he tells me is that he wants to put this part of his life behind him. He wants to sort of face justice in the United States and hopefully move on.
I mean, the whole narrative of this man being a homesick hijacker, it's kind of baffling. I mean, after feeling so strongly that his cause of black militancy in the U.S. needed an act like hijacking a plane, did you find that an odd explanation?
Perhaps. I mean, the man is 56 years old right now, and he was in his mid-20s, you know, when he committed this hijacking. At the time, he was, I think, very idealistic and militant in his beliefs. But I think what he found was a pretty rude awakening. He expected probably to be greeted as a fellow revolutionary. He had hoped to be trained as a guerrilla. And instead, a Cuban court convicted him of air piracy, which is essentially the Spanish term for hijacking. And he did 13 and a half years in prison.
And what's he been doing in Cuba all this time?
Well, back in 2009, we reported that he had spent at least some time operating an illegal internet cafe out of his house. When I spoke to him yesterday, he was living in a sort of suburban area outside of Havana, and he told me that he was farming.
What did Potts tell you before leaving about his feelings about returning to the U.S.?
He told me that he is just going to get there and see what it's like and sort of figure it out as he goes. And I think sort of figure out a new relationship with his homeland.
He says he wants closure, but can he get closure if he's going to do another prison sentence in the United States?
That certainly remains to be seen. His argument is that he served 13 and a half years in Cuba, and that should mean that he doesn't have to serve any time up in the United States. However, there is still an indictment pending against him in a Florida court. And in the past, the U.S. authorities have had sort of a mixed approach to returning fugitives. Some of them have been prosecuted very aggressively. Others have seen significantly reduced prison sentences. So we'll have to see what happens. I mean, it'll be up to legal authorities in the United States to figure out what's going to happen to him, although he's very clear in that his preference and his belief is that he shouldn't serve any additional time. As he told me, I did the crime and I did the time.
I mean, given his hopes of being treated like a hero on arrival in Cuba a number of years ago, it's hard to imagine that he really believes he's not going to do time here in the United States.
Well, I think that's his argument, and we'll just wait and see if it holds up in court.
The Associated Press's Peter Orsi in Havana. Thanks very much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Still to come on The World, how come the girl from Ipanema doesn't look like the other girls from Ipanema on PRI?
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association. November is Diabetes Awareness Month. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com and by Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Here in the U.S., we're used to hearing about how newspapers are dying off from a lack of readers and a lack of advertisers. But in Venezuela, the newspaper industry is hurting for another reason. Andrew Rosati reports from the city of Maturin.
Jose Luis Ferreira runs a newsstand in Maturin, and until recently, business was pretty good. But now he can't get enough papers to supply his customers.
Esta situación se viene dando ya hace unos tres meses. Nosotros por lo menos vendíamos prensa.
The situation with newspapers has been going on for about 3 months. We used to sell about 200 papers a day, but little by little sales have been dwindling. 180, then 150, and now we're selling 80 papers a day. It's a significant decline.
It isn't a news shortage, it's a newsprint shortage. After the death of President Hugo Chavez in March, inflation soared, and because of exchange controls, foreign currency, namely the U.S. dollar, has become increasingly scarce. That's a problem, because even in a country that has a hostile relationship with the U.S., dollars are paramount for importing goods. So now, everything from cooking oil to toilet paper is in short supply, even newsprint. That shortage is hitting the smaller, regional papers especially hard. Tenedo Guia is the president of the National College of Journalists.
Como incongruente pensar que en una administración política...
Isn't Congress that the policy for an administration that is striving towards socialism depends so much on the dollar? But the government hasn't supplied dollars to this industry. That's the reason there are shortages. Five papers have shut their doors already.
Maybe Gutierrez worked as a reporter at El Sol, Maturin's oldest daily newspaper, until last month. She was one of 20 employees who got laid off when the daily ran out of paper.
It caught me off guard. In the span of 2 days, we were guaranteed our jobs. Then, told we had to leave. It's a huge shock.
National newspapers aren't doing much better. According to the National College of Journalists, the lack of newsprint has forced 38 papers to reduce their page count. While the presses at El Nacional, one of the country's leading dailies, are still running, editor Miguel Ortero says they're in serious trouble.
We don't know if the government will want or will be able to give us the foreign currency to buy newsprint from Canada or the United States. We won't last after December if there is no further approbation of foreign currency. That's a reality. I imagine all the other newspapers are in the same situation.
But some wonder whether the government wouldn't mind if the paper shortage drove some newspapers out of business. Hugo Chavez closed dozens of radio stations and a number of cable news channels during his 14-year tenure, leaving independent print media as the harshest critic of the government, now led by Nicolas Maduro. Tenedo Guia, president of the National College of Journalists, says he's very concerned.
We don't want to think that this is a means of censorship that prohibits freedom of expression and opinion. It would be very dangerous for the country if this was a means of censorship.
The government isn't commenting one way or another. So for now, newspapers continue to shrink their page counts as they wait to get their hands on foreign currency. One temporary solution might be for them to focus on their digital editions. But editors point out that very few people in Venezuela read the news on computers or mobile phones. For them, the print edition is still what matters. For The World, this is Andrew Rosati, Maturin, Venezuela.
Next time you go see a movie, ask yourself these three questions. Does the film feature two named female characters? You know, not just Bank Teller 1 and 2. Do they talk to each other? And do they discuss something other than a man? That's a Bechdel test named after its inventor, cartoonist Alison Bechdel. And this test is now being used by some movie theaters in Sweden to rate their films on a gender parity scale. Ellen Tyler manages the Cinema Rio in Stockholm, Sweden.
When we find out about this and start to look on the movies that we've shown in the cinemas, we were shocked, and we thought, if we are shocked, maybe someone else is too. Maybe we should do something about that.
Well, we've actually got Alison Bechdel on the line with us. Alison, explain how the Bechdel test came up, because I know you were not working for the Motion Picture Association of America. This was in a strip. Explain the context.
You know, I'm still confused about how it became the Bechdel test. I'm actually sitting here reading the Guardian piece and looking at this website, the Bechdel test, trying to remember how this all happened. I wrote a comic strip 30 years ago in which I have these two characters talking about how hard it is to see a movie with, like, a female protagonist. And these are the criteria that they apply. And I totally stole this thing from a friend of mine. I keep trying to give her credit. It's not really my idea. My friend Liz Wallace in 1985 made a joke one day. She said, These are the rules I apply when I go to the movies. The movie has to have at least two women in it who talk to each other about something besides a man. I thought, great, that's really funny. I'm going to make a comic strip out of it because I didn't have any other ideas that week.
So it's not really the Bechdel test. It's the Liz Wallace test. Ellen, Tyler, I'm wondering just how difficult it is to apply a Bechdel rating to films there at your theaters.
The Bechdel test is really simple. Two women talking to each other about something besides men. And all the movies that we put on the cinemas, we put a sticker on them with this little label saying approved Bechdel test. That's the only thing it's saying. It's not about quality or if it's a feminist movie or not. It's just passing these questions. That's it. And you also will have it on the website and you will have it on the screen just before the movie starts in cinemas. I hope Allison liked the idea. We had this mail conversation for 1 year ago, if you remember.
Yeah. I'm very excited about it. I think it's really cool. I have to say, the principle of having female protagonists being made into movies, that's all about what I've been working at my whole life, is to create women who are subjects.
Allison, do you kind of still run this test in the back of your mind yourself when you go to the movies or you think about going to a film?
Honestly, I don't. I would not see very many movies if I did.
Do you think there's been progress, though, since you first sketched that out?
Absolutely. There's been tremendous progress. In recent years, I think a real revolution in allowing women to just be regular humans in the movies and on television.
What's the best example of that you've seen recently?
You know, the first thing that pops into my head is the TV show Girls. I'm not even thinking of a movie right now, sorry, where these women characters get to be their whole flawed selves in a way that women typically haven't. Women, for many years, have been mostly props in movies and television.
Well, I wanted to throw one example out there, this controversial French film that was critically acclaimed at Cannes this past year, Blue is the Warmest Color. It's a story about two lesbians falling in love. Men are incidental, but the film was made by a man. How do you deal with that film on the Bechdel scale?
I don't think the person making the movie factors in. It's a simple metric. As long as it fulfills those three requirements, it doesn't matter who made it.
Yeah, we will show that movie in our cinema, and I haven't seen it yet either, but I heard it's a great movie. I'm longing to see it, and it passed the Bechdel test as well, so it will have this A label on it, and we will be proud of it.
A for Allison. That was Ellen Tyler, manager of the Cinema Rio in Stockholm, which is using the Bechdel test to rate its movies, and cartoonist Allison Bechdel, who drew the cartoon that sparked the test. We've been buzzing all day about this movie rating system here in the newsroom, and we want to hear from you, too. What's your film submission that meets the Bechdel criteria? Add your thoughts at PRI.org. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, what do you get when you combine Ethiopian artists with hip-hop beats, plus two mad musical scientists from North Carolina?
We put 16 students together, had a mind meld with the Apple Juice Kid at the boards, and that's the baby that popped out.
We'll take a listen, plus celebrating a peace breakthrough in Eastern Congo.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, supporting the American Diabetes Association in their effort to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by diabetes. You can test your risk for diabetes at StopDiabetesNow.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. People living in the Mexican border city of Juarez are eager to say goodbye to one of the bloodiest times in the city's history. For years, a drug war raged there, claiming more than 10,000 lives. Things are improving now, but echoes of the violence remain, especially on the city's outskirts. From the public radio collaboration Fronteras, Monica Ortiz Uribe tells a story now of how one neighborhood is trying to look after its young people.
It's the dawn of a new day in Ciudad Juarez. Just a few weeks ago, a new mayor was sworn into office. In his inaugural speech, Enrique Serrano stressed that the city will no longer be distracted by bullets.
Ya pasó la tormenta y se plantea un futuro provisorio para Juárez.
Serrano said the storm is behind them now and that the future of Juárez looks promising. Indeed, much of Juárez is breathing a sigh of relief. The murder rate back in 2010 averaged 8 people a day. Now it's less than 2 per day. There are also fewer kidnappings and car thefts. And new businesses are popping up in places that were once abandoned. But by no means is Juarez rid of its violent past. On the western edge of the city is a former squatter community called Anapra. Drive down one of the few paved roads here, and instead of sidewalks, you'll see margins of desert sand littered with potato chip bags and threadbare socks. Women push rickety strollers and lug grocery bags across a treeless terrain. This place is also known for being a recruitment zone for organized crime.
Ah, bueno, mira, mi nombre es María de Lourdes Contreras Castañeda.
It's also a place where Lourdes Contreras is trying to make a difference. She's 46 and grew up in Anapra. She knows there's little opportunity here. So, a year ago, Contreras decided to open up a study center for troubled youth. It's called Los Soles, named after the sun. Inside, children sit at a tiny table scribbling with markers. Others practice multiplication tables. In the kitchen, a volunteer mother heats up tortillas for lunch. Up to 70 kids can stream through here on any given day.
Hijos de drogadictos, de prostitutas, niños maltratados.
Contreras says they're kids left behind by the violence, children of addicts, prostitutes, and smugglers, she says. Many were abandoned and abused. In some of their notebooks, there's pictures of bleeding hearts and stick figures shooting bullets from a car. One of the more extreme cases is that of 4-year-old Kimberly. In an interview, she innocently offers fragments of the horror she lived, how she witnessed her parents getting murdered earlier this year. They were left tortured and bound inside their home. Kimberly spent the night hugging their corpses. The next morning, she turned up at her grandma's house, soaked in their blood.
Están en el cielo.
Now she says, my parents are in heaven. Outside the study center, some girls sing and play. Los Soles survives off donations. When drug violence in Juarez reached its peak, the federal government invested $250 million to support violence prevention programs like this. But that money's running out. Howard Campbell is an anthropology professor in neighboring El Paso.
The problems of Juarez, the longstanding problems of poverty, lack of opportunity, poor schools remain and are only improved by the actual efforts of private citizens themselves.
There's only so much the volunteers at Los Soles can do. Most are mothers and grandmothers who never finish school. They help the kids with their homework, provide a little food, and encourage them to stay out of trouble. But the odds are against them. As long as there's profit to be made smuggling people and drugs across the border, these children will continue to be courted by organized crime.
Consequently, you have fertile ground for another round of violence and social problems in Juarez.
For now, the people of Anapra are enjoying a tenuous peace, while the volunteers at Los Soles work in hopes of a better tomorrow. For The World, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe in Ciudad Juarez.
Brazil is one of the world's most racially diverse countries, but you wouldn't know it if you look at fashion models employed by the country's fashion industry. For years, diversity campaigners have complained about the almost total lack of non-white models in the industry. Well, this week, a small victory for those campaigners. The organizers of Rio's Fashion Week, which starts today, reportedly agreed to increase diversity on the catwalk. The BBC's Julia Carneiro is in Rio. What exactly was this agreement, Julia?
Well, the company that organizes Fashion Rio, which is the main fashion event here in the city, will recommend that all brands taking part in the event have at least 10% of models of African descent in their shows. And public defenders that participated in this negotiation will monitor this to see if they really fulfill what they promised.
A 10% quota, that's in a country with a 50% black population. We're not even factoring in indigenous people and other non-whites. That doesn't sound like much.
Well, it isn't very much, but it is better than nothing. I've been to this event before, and we always have this majority of white models. And I guess This is really well illustrated by an emblematic fact that happened here last week in the Fashion Week in São Paulo. There was a very famous fashion designer had a show dedicated to Africa, but almost all the models were white. There were only two mulattas, models of mixed race.
How did the diversity campaigners react to this 10%?
Well, the NGO called Educafro, who has been pushing for this to happen, they said that it's not enough. They want to keep campaigning for more. But this event starts today. This agreement was reached yesterday. So it was really decided on short notice. And for the industry to be able to meet the agreement, they said it was okay, but they will push for more in the next editions. They said they really need to see more of Brazil's diversity in the catwalks, especially since it's well, that's where so many role models come from, where so many young people look up to those beautiful women wearing beautiful clothes and want to be like them. So it's really important for the country's identity.
Right. I mean, Gisele Bündchen, I think our listeners will know her, one of the best-known Brazilian models, but she's white. Even her name is German. She doesn't really evoke Brazil. Just how important is the fashion industry as far as defining self-image in Brazil?
It's hugely important. We have this very diverse population. Gisele Bündchen is from the south, where we had lots of German and Italian migration. But of course, we had a huge African migration to Brazil in the times of slavery. And this is not seen in the fashion industry, and it's not seen in the country's elites as well. And there has been lots of pressures from campaigners in the past decades for this to change. And now we're starting to see some policies in that direction.
So by agreeing to this 10% quota, Brazil's fashion industry basically is employing affirmative action to change things. Has affirmative action been tried before in Brazil? Is there any influence from the U.S.?
Marco, yes, there are lots of examples of affirmative action now in Brazil. This started with universities adopting affirmative action and establishing quotas. President Dilma Rousseff opened a conference for racial equality that's taking place right now in Brasilia, our capital. And she said she is asking legislators to approve a law that seeks to establish a reserve also in the public service of a 20% reserve for people of African descent working for the federal government. So this would be a next step of affirmative action as we've been seeing develop in the country.
So it's not strictly a fashion issue. There seems to be this overall national growing awareness of racial discrimination as a political issue in Brazil.
Well, campaigners have been fighting for this for a very long time. And I think we've reached the moment that it's very hard to ignore that you have very few Black people among the elites in universities, in leading positions. And now, after such a long time of campaigning, public policies are trying to push for that to change gradually as well.
The BBC's Julia Carneiro in Rio de Janeiro. Thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem. Talk to you soon.
Here's a relatively good news story from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Jubilant residents of eastern Congo are pouring into the streets this week. They're celebrating a decision by the ruthless rebel group known as M23 to lay down its weapons. The rebels had been fighting Congo's army for more than a year before government forces routed the insurgents in their last stronghold. That was a bit of a surprise in Congo, where government soldiers are better known for corruption, looting, and rape than for their professionalism. Photographer Pete Muller says he's seeing a new discipline in the Congolese armed forces. He was with Congolese soldiers as they launched their final assault on the rebels in a town called Bunagana.
It's about a 12-mile uphill hike. What I witnessed was Congolese soldiers, commando units, advanced infantry units, marching in a single file line up the left side of this road continuously with virtually no interruption.
Wow.
It was quite an impressive feat of discipline and determination for these Congolese soldiers to reach this last holdout of the rebels.
Right. And that's not kind of typical, this very disciplined marching pattern.
Well, no, I mean, I was not in eastern Congo when the Congolese army lost control of Goma last year. But, you know, as all of the photographs and all of the reporting indicated, as soon as the M23 rebels started making rapid territorial advances, the FARDC basically were running alongside with the civilian population. And they basically abandoned the defense of Goma and they fled south and basically handed the city over to the rebels.
Yeah, big difference. You've described, Pete, a military priest who you think might have played a role in building the morale of this unit of the Congolese army. Tell us who this man is. I mean, we know he's a colonel in the army. What else do you know?
Colonel Aaron Kibuta is a really fascinating figure that I came across in the weeks before the fighting erupted, who was making sermons at least twice a week on the absolute front line where the Congolese army was within shouting distance of the M23 rebels. And he would come up twice a week, and he would give these extraordinarily impassioned sermons that both put the battle that the Congolese foot soldiers were at that stage about to embark upon into almost biblical terms, using biblical referencing to justify and build the morale of these soldiers to go on and fight the rebels who, in his perception and among Congolese and international observers, are backed by foreign countries, namely Uganda and Rwanda. So he was using religion, which is such a powerful instrument and cultural facet of the way that people exist in Congo, to build morale, but at the same time, utilizing that force, that religious force, to preach vehemently against abuses of the civilian population.
I gather the rebels could hear him giving these speeches as well.
He would put himself in positions with a megaphone. And Mark, I'm saying we were at the absolute and most advanced point at that time. You could see the rebels on the other side of the line. And he would address them. He would place his physical body in their direction and preach in their direction. It almost was as though he was telling not just the Congolese army troops that he was there formally to preach to, but that he was directing his message to some degree at the M23 rebels, which were about 100 meters down the road.
So, Pete, you were there when the fighting ceased in one eastern town in Congo. Take us to that moment, please.
Well, we had been advancing with the Congolese forces up the road to a town called Bunagana the entire day, and it was a sweltering hot day. There was very little shade. It was very eerie moving along with that column of troops because, you know, at that stage, the rebels had lost such extraordinary amounts of territory over such a short amount of time. I was sort of fearful that they may resort to any types of sort of last-ditch tactics to protect this last bastion that they controlled. There were skirmishes along the road, sort of mild, medium arms fire skirmishes that sort of came and went quickly. At the end of the day, we arrived in the town of Bunagana, and I came up just as sort of the last heavy round of 50 caliber machine gun fire had died down. We'd sort of been taking a bit of cover behind a tank, and you got the impression that the town was completely vacant. But as soon as those last rounds came out of that 50 caliber gun, it was extraordinary. The civilian population just poured out of the houses where they'd sort of locked themselves inside. And the celebratory atmosphere was really extraordinary. And there's a photograph that you can look at that appeared recently in the New York Times slideshow of the barrel of that 50 caliber gun still smoking and hundreds of people gathering around it and singing and cheering and welcoming the Congolese forces into the town. The previous M23 rebel headquarters had been sort of ransacked, and all of their paperwork and all this stuff had been strewn about in the main square. And it was a very exuberant atmosphere in Bunagana.
Pete Muller, a freelance photographer who works regularly for the New York Times. You can see his incredible photos from Eastern Congo at PRI.org. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Reputation.com, dedicated to helping individuals and businesses make a strong first impression on the Internet by ensuring accurate search results and authentic online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's Wednesday, Beatmaking Lab time. It's a project that teaches students around the globe how to produce hip-hop beats. For the last few weeks, we've been checking in with lab co-founders Pierce Freelon and Stephen Levitin, a.k.a. Applejuice Kid. Their latest lab partners are in Ethiopia, and they've been cooking up a whole new song.
Yeah.
Music created and produced by students taking part in the beat-making lab in Ethiopia. Freelon and Apple Juice Kid will be going there in a few days to check in on the students. But before they go, they join me from station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. So, Pierce, what we just heard, is that the final product from the beat-making lab?
That is the final product. We put 16 students together, had a mind meld with Apple Juice Kid at the boards, and that's the baby that popped out.
Wow. I mean, sonically, it's really cool, and the video is pretty nice, too, which we will have on our website, PRI.org. How do you guys feel about what came out of this lab?
I'm so happy with the final product, the final music video and the music that was created. I think when you listen to it, you'll hear the quality and the experimentation and that we were really going for something unique where we combined traditional Ethiopian elements along with electronic and hip-hop elements.
It looks, the video looks and sounds very Ethiopian. We see Ethiopia, but I kept on thinking as I went through it, Stephen, I mean, how much is this them and their own inspirations, and how much is this you two, American guys, who bring their own sensibility to the musical canvas?
I mean, we definitely have an influence. We're teaching them how to make these beats and guiding them in the process of making a complete song. But we attempt at every moment to gather their own interests and own desires in making their final piece of music. So they definitely produced this final piece of music. Pierce and I was like Puff Daddy of the session. we oversaw it, but tried to guide them in a way that we thought would be great.
And do they see you guys as kind of, you know, the American idols at this point?
I think it was really more like collaborators. I think, you know, we were in the trenches with them for 2 weeks every day. You know, we had, you know, our filmmakers going home and hanging out with their families. And, you know, they were coming and kicking it at our hotel to build before performances and sessions. And so, you know, I don't know that idol is the appropriate term. I'd say more like, you know, collaborator, you know, a community member, definitely trying to build community more than we're trying to establish some kind of hierarchical where the producers do what we say. They actually came with a lot of musical input and talent and thoughts that were directing us more than the other way around a lot of the time. Mm.
Now, one of the students you guys have profiled in your weekly videos is a young woman named Galila. We've talked about her before when you and I have spoken. Let's just hear Galila rapping in this final video. So, Pierce, will you see Galila when you go back to Addis?
Yeah, we'll definitely see Galila, and really excited to reunite with her and the other community members from the Beatmaking Lab.
Addis Ababa is such a cool city. Putting music aside, is there anything you guys are looking forward to when you go back?
Yeah, the food. Anyone that's had Ethiopian food knows that it's a special cuisine that is rarely seen in America. So there's this injera bread, there's a type of meat called tibbs. Everything is extremely fresh and unique flavors at every step.
Mm, and don't forget to mention tennis. They have the illest tennis situation in Addis Ababa. Like right down the street from our hotel, there's this red clay court where these, like, you know, 14-year-old, very small kids are, like, getting their Wimbledon on. It was just really amazing. I'm excited about that, too.
Do you guys play tennis?
Yeah, no. Apple Juice actually is my tennis teacher. And what's another interesting thing—
You know, I'm his tennis collaborator.
Collaborator, yes. Good call. But, you know, Ethiopia is at a very high altitude. So, you know, when you take a deep breath in Ethiopia, you're bringing in less oxygen than you would be here. So, you know, you get winded quickly. It's just a really interesting area on a lot of levels.
Good for maybe one set, and then you're out of breath.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So before you guys head off, there is a beat-making challenge that you've thrown down, and it's open actually to any beat makers out there. Stephen, what is the challenge?
Okay, the challenge is each country we find a unique instrument or situation to gather sounds from and then ask, put out a call to the world to sample these sounds and make it in a specific genre that we choose. So for Ethiopia, we have chosen an instrument called the masinko, which is a one-string violin kind of instrument. And also we went to a soccer game of Ethiopia versus South Africa, and we have some chants and sounds of the soccer or football game we went to. So producers or beat makers out there have to combine both samples into the genre of a Zonto or Afrobeat. And Fuse ODG is our judge. Walshy Fire of Major Lazer is the host. And Fuse is the expert in a Zonto. I think he basically invented the genre. And so that's, you know, we try to find some cutting edge new genres. We've done trap. We've done rhythms from Jamaica.
And actually solicited that genre from our contenders every time we have people submit. And that Zonto was a suggestion from the community, the beatmaking community that's been participating in these challenges.
All right. So if you are a beatmaker or you've ever desired to be a beatmaker, come to PRI.org and you can find out the rest of the challenge and get all the bits to make your Zonto mix. The winner will be announced next week when you guys are in Ethiopia. In the meantime, let's go out with the man who invented this whole genre of Zonto, Fuse ODG, and his original hit. Piers Freelon and Stephen Levitin, thanks so much. Have a great trip.
Thanks.
Thank you.
It's Fuse. See, I just came back from Ghana. And I wanna share the stuff that everyone's doing over there. Nobody wanna see you rising. And when they do, they don't even like it. They just wanna see you deep in crisis. Drive yourself, you don't need the license. Hold the hush, you can even ride it. Go ahead, move your feet just like this. Then he showed me the latest. We walk over the pictures. And what you do, my Zonto.
One thing I love about this job, I get to ask a lot of questions every day of all kinds of people all over the globe. But maybe you hear me missing something, or you have your own questions. Well, here's your chance to ask them. After all, this is your world, too. So just text your world, one word, your world to 69866 to sign up, and you'll receive instructions on how to participate. Join our newsroom. You ask, we'll try to answer. It's your world here on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at RitaAllen.org. By the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund. And by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, Ken and Lucy Lehman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.